legitimate response to the act of aggression. Ismail Baghaei also slammed the inaction of the UN Security Council in the face of Israeli violations against the sovereignty and territorial integrity of regional countries, including Syria and Lebanon. Earlier, Hamas and Islamic Jihad, as well as Qatar, separately condemned the raid on the Syrian town of Beit Jin. And Syrian civilians injured in Israeli forces' attack on Beit Jin were then transferred to a Damascus hospital for treatment. Let's listen to what some had to say about the ordeal they witnessed.
Israeli forces attempted to detain men from the village, but residents resisted and clashes erupted. The troops pulled back, but returned with airstrikes and heavy shelling. They bombed several homes and the mosque. Some lost their lives and others got injured.
At 3 in the morning, Israeli forces stormed our village, trying to seize one of the young men. We resisted, and there were dead and wounded. At 6 a.m., after they withdrew from Beit Jin, we moved toward a damaged vehicle, and they opened fire on us. Then came the airstrikes, planes, artillery, rockets. I was hit by artillery fire and got injured. This wasn't the first time. 4 or 5 months ago, they took 7 men from our village. So now, whenever they come, we resist. After pulling back, they returned with planes and rockets, striking the village. They attacked from the air with heavy machine guns, helicopters, drones, mortars, raining fire on us.
We opened fire at the Israeli patrol to defend ourselves and prevent them from arresting us. My brother was martyred, and I got injured.
The hospital has received 16 wounded. 5 members of one family arrived dead. Earlier, 11 injured were brought in, among them a woman who did not survive. 2 patients remain in critical condition and are now in operation room.
And we were earlier joined by journalist Robert Fantina. He says the Israeli violations against regional countries, including Syria, are all part of a plot to occupy more territory amid international silence.
What we continue to see Israel doing is trying to expand its own territory in violation of international law, certainly, which says that territory can't be gained through conquest. So we're seeing this country, the Zionist regime, which is always saying it's the victim, bombing yet another country, bombing and killing innocent people, innocent men, women, and children. Several children were killed in this. Homes were bombed. What is the strategic reason for bombing homes, private residences? There isn't any. It's simply the fact that the Israeli regime, the Zionist regime, wants to clear out anybody who is living in territory that it wants. The fact that this is yet another instance of Israeli violation of international law is just appalling. When is the world government, is the world community going to say this is enough? This must stop. We see what's happening in Lebanon and in Palestine, both in Gaza and the West Bank. Now Syria, this is a rogue nation that is completely out of control, and it needs to be reined in.
As well, Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem condemned Israel for the assassination of Haitham Ali Tabtabai, vowing resistance will retaliate.
The expression and the stance which I am announcing against the martyrdom of the Mahdi Sayyid Abu Ali, may God bless him and his comrades, this is a blatant aggression and a clear crime, and it is our right to respond, and we will determine the time for this.
Speaking at a memorial for the late commander, Sheikh Qassem, so the regional American intelligence provide the Israeli regime with the information that allows it to operate comfortably in Lebanese territory. He said the ceasefire is a victory for resistance, adding Israel failed to eliminate the resistance and then thus had to agree to an arrangement. Naim Qassem stressed the Lebanese state is responsible to ensure Israel's withdrawal and then deploy the army in the south. As well, the leader said the resistance weapons liberated Lebanon after decades of occupation and remain the only deterrence power against Israel's expansionist plans. He said U.S. and Israel are trying to strip Lebanon of its defensive capability, indicating the real threat lies in Israeli expansionism and not Hezbollah's arms. Now, the Gaza ceasefire agreement has not stopped Israel from launching attacks against the Palestinian territory. The regime's military has killed over 350 Palestinians since the truce took effect. And let's cross over now to our correspondent, Andero Bala God Ibrahim, for your latest on the ground out of Gaza. Got a good to check in with you. Hope you're safe and doing well out there in central Gaza this morning. What more do you have to add to our update for others?
Yes, as you know and as you mentioned before, the Israeli violations of the U.S. brokered ceasefire agreement are continuous, and this actually comes in the form of the Israeli attacks that are ravaging the eastern parts of the Gaza Strip from the north to the south. In the south of the Strip, we have very heavy airstrikes and artillery shelling targeting the eastern parts of Rafah and also the eastern parts of Khan Yunis City. The latest of these attacks resulted in two Palestinian children killed. Both of them were children and both of them were brothers in the eastern parts of Beni Sahela area. Again, these attacks are ravaging the eastern parts of Gaza City and the eastern parts of Khan Yunis City on a daily basis and around the hour. We have also heavy airstrikes and heavy artillery shelling on the eastern parts of Gaza City, like Ash-Sha'af and At-Tufah neighborhoods in the north of the Strip. And also we have more airstrikes in the eastern parts of Beit Lahia and Jabalia refugee camp in the north of the Strip. These attacks are continuously causing more bloodshed among the Palestinians since the beginning of the ceasefire. Until now, we have at least 350 Palestinians killed. More than 900 Palestinians were injured, and this number is increasing every passing day because of the continuation of these attacks and because these attacks are violent and are causing not only more damage but also more bloodshed among the most devastated population here in the Gaza Strip. Most of these attacks happen to be behind the so-called yellow line in areas that are completely under the Israeli control and under the Israeli firepower. However, more attacks are also taking place on the western parts of the Gaza Strip. We have warships opening fire towards the coastline of Gaza City and Al-Mawasi area in the western parts of the Strip that are actually inflicting more injuries and causing more injuries among the displaced people who are cramming along the coastline of the Gaza Strip. And let me speed up on the latest from UNICEF, that UNICEF report that actually indicates that at least 9,300 Palestinian children under the age of 5 are diagnosed with acute severe malnutrition since the start of October until this moment. This again highlights how these Palestinians are living unimaginable catastrophic humanitarian situations even after the ceasefire went into effect, and that highlights how most of the population cannot have access to food and to the proper medication in order like to alleviate the suffering of these Palestinians even after the ceasefire went into effect, highlighting again how the Israeli occupation army is not allowing enough amounts of food and medications into the Gaza Strip.
Thank you, Gada, for that update. Stay safe and talk to you soon. Gada Abraham joining us from central Gaza. Meanwhile, the United Nations says violence by Israeli forces and settlers in occupied West Bank has surged over the past 2 years, leaving over 1,000 Palestinians dead. Says there's almost been zero accountability.
Our office has verified that since the 7th of October 2023 and up until the 27th of November of this year, Israeli forces and settlers killed 1,030 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem. Among these victims were 223 children.
Hello, welcome to the press briefing.
Lawrence also cited recent disturbing incident in city of Jenin, where Israeli occupation forces were filmed, shooting dead two Palestinian men trying to surrender. The UN has already called for an independent, prompt, and effective probe into Israeli killing of the Palestinians, and then for those responsible to be held fully accountable. Hundreds of Israeli soldiers, backed by the armored vehicles, have recently carried out sweeping raids across the occupied West Bank. This is the largest military deployment since last month's ceasefire in Gaza. And joining us earlier with your update, occupied West Bank, was a Ramallah correspondent, Naka Ahmed.
Let me start by some news from the ground. On the fourth day of the military aggression, the five pillars in the northern part of the occupied West Bank, precisely in Tubas, where the Israeli soldiers, the Israeli forces last night have withdrawn from the village of Tammun and from Al-Far'a refugee camp. And by withdrawn, we mean that they have withdrawn from inside these places, not leave it and and raised the military sanction over these areas, Aqaba, Tayasir, and Tubas, throughout the night, have faced many aggressions and many attacks. 29 Palestinians have been abducted from inside Al-Far'a refugee camp, fiercely interrogated, and many of them were assaulted. 27 have been beaten severely. The Israeli forces continues to affirm that the entire Tubas province is a closed military zone. Nablus was also under attack throughout the night. In Jenin, the situation is also tensive.
And staying with the occupied West Bank, residents of the village of Tamun, they're in occupied territories, have been recounting their ordeal. Let's have a listen.
They punched me and beat me with their feet all over my body. Then they unleashed the dog on me, and it bit me several times. Then they brought my brother into the shower and brought the dog in with him. They continued with the same method.
Twenty homes were completely evacuated of their residence and turned into military barracks. More than 100 people were arrested from all neighborhoods of the town of Tamun, and methods of physical and psychological torture were used against them. They were left for long hours in the freezing cold without care or attention.
They brought me into a room. One of them took a hookah pipe and hit me on the head with it. Then they threw me on the floor and started beating me with metal rods, iron pieces, glass, and anything they could find. One of them even lifted a couch and hit me with it. They used every possible method of beating.
The U.S. has been escalating pressure against Venezuela in recent months under the pretext of fighting drug trafficking. It's launched airstrikes on boats in the Caribbean and South Pacific, deployed warships possibly in preparation for military action. Camila Escalante has traveled to an eastern Venezuelan state for this report.
Venezuela has been the subject of intense media attention in recent months as the United States doubles down on its pressure aimed at overthrowing the government in Caracas. In the eastern state of Anzoátegui, an assembly of local leadership meets as part of a process to fortify the United Socialist Party, the PSUV, from the grassroots level.
What the Venezuelans want is peace, prosperity, and we have our own democratic system. We have elections. We are even electing at this moment communities and popular power all over the country.
Venezuela held another election on Sunday to vote on local projects at the communal level, which will be funded by the state. And while the spectacle continues on social media, daily routines seem unaffected.
Things are happening. People are going to the beaches. People are going to party. People are working, are studying. But we are also getting ready for any scenario. If the imperialism of the USA tries to attack Venezuela, we'll know how to answer, and we will prevail. Venezuelans, the only thing we want is to be respected, and for the world and for the great powers to respect our sovereignty, to respect our people and our self-determination.
Throughout the country, daily life continues for Venezuelans against the backdrop of the incessant campaign of aggression leveled by the United States against the country as the massive military buildup escalates in the Caribbean Sea.
Governor of Anzoátegui, Luis José Mercado, says while calm reigns, Venezuelans are prepared to defend their nation.
In our state of Anzoátegui, which is part of the Caribbean coastal region of our country, we have entered a period of permanent mobilization. What we have done for these past 3 months or more is carry out intense activity involving military, police, and popular mobilizations. Each of our 205 community circuits has an organization with militia units that have been mobilizing, holding night marches and meetings, conducting training exercises, and carrying out military-style preparations. In Venezuela, the majority of us, the women and men of this nation, are absolutely determined to preserve our independence and our sovereignty.
Venezuela is a country at peace, advancing in its various transformative projects, strengthening its economy in the face of the economic blockade, and guarding its sovereignty. Camila Escalante, Anzoátegui.
European aerospace company Airbus has just ordered urgent recall of over 6,000 A320 family aircraft after mid-air incident exposed serious software flaw in flight control systems. European Union Aviation Safety Agency directed airlines to revert to earlier software before flights can resume. Now, this recall is among the largest in Airbus history. It affects more than half the global A320 fleet, causing widespread cancellations and delays. Move follows an October flight from Mexico to the U.S. that experienced a sudden altitude drop, injuring 15 passengers. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
I am free. Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means...
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from...
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decreed.
His decree, though...
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah. Today's tip, how management is manifested in worship and in ubudiyah, our servitude and our obedience to Allah. Welcome back, dear friends. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about how management is manifested in ubudiyah, in our worship, in our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. So, you know, just like all of the various different aspects of our life, you know, management is manifested also in our ubudiyah, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. You know, the whole universe, the earth, the, you know, solar system, all of these things are in a very beautiful harmony, and they are in a certain order, and that order is really what is called management. Now, when we come out of this very universal idea of management, you know, and we come down to the earth, we see that everything upon the earth, you know, plant life, animal life, the various different ecosystems across the world, they are all in this very beautiful, managed, ordered, and organized state. And this is one of the beauties of the natural world and the overall solar system and the galaxies and the universe and the cosmos, is that there's this very beautiful order and this beautiful management of all of these things. And it really, the more you think about it, you know, the more amazing all of it really seems. So if anybody, you know, if you have a pet at home, you will realize that cleaning up after a pet is incredibly tedious. I mean, you constantly have to feed the pet, you know, you have to constantly clean the pet, you have to constantly clean up after the pet. And when you look at the natural world, there's nobody, you know, cleaning up after all of these animals that are in the wild or the plant life, or nobody's actively feeding any of them. There's like, I don't know, millions of animals and millions of plants and millions of insects. But this beautiful management is very, you know, divinely manifested in the natural world. And then when we come to human beings, we see that the body is very beautifully managed. And so likewise, this management can also be very clearly seen in the social issues of humanity, the political issues of humanity, the economic issues of humanity. And so when we look at worship, when we look at ubudiyah, you know, and the servitude and the obedience to the Almighty Allah, of course, this management is also manifested in this ubudiyah. IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
The reality of order is one of the greatest proofs of God's existence. There is such an order in everything in the universe. from a fly's wing to the stars in the skies, to an atom to the depths of the seas, that it reflects the Creator's existence like a sun. Yes, order can only emerge from a single hand. If many hands interfere in a task, then it becomes muddled. A country cannot have two kings, a province cannot have two governors, and a village cannot have two chiefs. If there are two heads, then there will be disorder, since this universe has order instead of chaos. God, who established this order, must be existent and unique. This exquisite order, which is in sight, cannot be explained by anything other than God's existence. The Holy Quran attracts the attention to this reality with the following verse: He who created the seven heavens, one above another, no want of proportion wilt thou see in the creation of God, most gracious. So turn thy vision again. Seest thou any flaw? Again, turn thy vision a second time. Thy vision will come back to thee dull and discomfited, in a state worn out. Surah Al-Mulk, verses 3 to 4. Books with loads of volumes can be written and have been written to explain the universe's order. A book can be written even regarding the orderliness of a fly's body. We will only examine the smallest building block of material, the atom, and refer the balance found in the universe and its articles to science books. Everything from the air, water, mountains, animals, plants, and our bodies, to the sofa that you are sitting on. In summary, everything that you see, from the smallest to the largest, everything you touch and feel, is comprised of atoms. Atoms are so small that it is not possible to see these tiny particles even through the most powerful microscopes. Let us try to demonstrate the smallness of atoms through an example. Imagine having a key in your hand. Surely, it is impossible for you to see the atoms in this key. Let us assume that you maximized the key to the Earth's dimensions so that you could see these atoms. If the key was maximized to Earth's dimensions, only then could you see that every atom in that key was the size of a cherry. Every atom comprises a nucleus, and every nucleus has been formed from the electrons revolving in the orbits very far away. The radius of a nucleus is about 1/10,000th of an atom's radius. Let us look for the nucleus and the atoms that are the size of cherries when we bring the key to the Earth's dimensions. However, this search is futile, because even on this type of scale, we do not have the opportunity to observe a nucleus that is so small. We could see the nucleus only when the cherry that represents our atom would have to grow into a ball that is 200 meters tall. Despite this inconceivable dimension, our atom's nucleus would not amount to anything larger than a very small dust particle. Now, if you wish, let us picture the order of this tiny structure. Due to their electric charges, the electrons in the atom continuously spin around the nucleus. All electrons are negatively charged, whereas all protons are positively charged. The positive charge within the atom's nucleus pulls the electrons towards it, and for that reason, the electrons are unable to separate from around its surroundings. The number of protons in the center of an atom is equal to the number of electrons on the outside. Thus, the atom's electrical charge is balanced. However, the proton's volume and mass are more than those of an electron. If a comparison has to be made, it is like the difference in size between a human and a hazelnut. Nevertheless, their electric charges are the same. What would happen if their electric charges were not equal? In that case, every atom in the universe, due to the extra positive electricity, would possess a positive charge. As a result, every atom in the universe would push one another.
Welcome back, dear friends. So we are talking about how management is manifested in ubudiyya, in our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. So now when we start to look at worship, of course, the Almighty Allah has made certain kinds of worship wajib, obligatory. That means that we have to do this because perhaps this is the bare minimum, and that bare minimum has been made obligatory because perhaps if that bare minimum was not to be obligatory and wajib, then we would never engage even in that bare minimum. It's quite profound if you, you know, rewind, listen to it again and think about it, that the reason that, for example, the five daily prayers that are wajib and are wajib and obligatory because they are the bare minimum of what an individual should do who wants to engage in ubudiyya, in the worship, in the servitude, and the obedience to the Almighty Allah. And if this bare minimum was not made obligatory by the Almighty Allah, then unfortunately, we human beings would not even engage in that bare minimum worship of the Almighty Allah. So even making these five daily prayers wajib and obligatory, in reality is a huge favor and a blessing to every single human being. So anyways, when we look at the management, of course, these five daily prayers, you have five. That's managed in a very specific way. You know, when you continue in and you look at the various different details of the prayer, you know, you stand for a certain time, you recite something while you're standing in qiyam, in ruku, in the genuflection, you know, you are there for a certain period of time. There's a certain dhikr or a certain recitation you make there. You know, then you have two sujood, right? You have two prostrations. Between the two prostrations, you pause. So when you look at the whole prayer, it is very beautifully managed and very beautifully organized, you know? And so even when you have congregational prayers, there is a specific person who leads the prayers. That person who leads the prayers has certain requirements. The people are all lined up, you know, in a certain fashion. They all bow down at the same time. They stand up at the same time. They go into prostration at the same time, right? And all of it is very beautifully managed, and it shows this very beautiful organization, this discipline, this like the solar system. It really is something very beautiful to observe. And even our other, you know, forms of worship and our other forms of ubudiyya, they also have a certain kind of manifestation of management, you know. Again, management is not something that is very dry or very boring or very, you know, I don't know, type X behavior, personality. No, management is this beautiful order and organization that is manifested in all of the cosmos. And so it is very natural and very harmonious for it to also be manifested in our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Foresight. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah. حسبنا الله.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to Women of Resistance. 19-year-old Zahra Abdul Karim Mohanna had a single priority during the two-year genocide raging on them in Gaza, that is to protect her brothers and save their lives at any cost. Having lost her father, she preferred pangs of hunger than risk her brothers going to seek aid where scores of young men were targeted, disappeared, and shot. They have resisted the occupation and always will, Zahra says, but asks why they need to do that when the rest of the world is free. Here is more of Zahra.
Despite the history, occupation, and Gaza's classification as the world's largest open-air prison, by many who experienced its suffocating conditions, there was a semblance of a life. For young Palestinians like the one who shared her story with us, there was a rhythm to life, with the Israeli occupation simply the soundtrack. Building a future despite Gaza's situation was something that kept the next generation hopeful, studying, preparing, and working towards a day when there would be a different world. Israel's barbarity has replaced that with something utterly different. Life under genocide was a literal hellscape. The struggle to find something to eat outweighed by the psychological torture, in Zahra's case, of wondering if the occupation would martyr or take her brothers at any given moment. Activities once considered routine now took on an additional layer of jeopardy. Some of the sights witnessed are enough to change your very DNA, such as the tragedy playing out in real time. It's not just the obvious lack of regard for Palestinian lives, it's also the way in which Israel's genocide has changed even the landscape of Gaza. Orphans have been created, children forever scarred in an environment that is now completely alien, with all familiarity wiped from the face of the earth. Coming to terms with the new reality of Gaza has altered some things. There is no way the people, the ones who survived in any case, would not emerge unscathed, though the one thing that has remained is the Palestinian steadfastness. It was terrifying how quickly Zahra's life, like the lives of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, became centered on the search to satiate hungry bellies. With such scarcity, finding sustenance would consume Gazan lives. Every day, Zahra checks in on the condition of her immediate family, a literal head count, and then begins the soul-sapping business of making it through another day. The genocide has left those who have survived it physically absolutely spent. The new truce, or the so-called ceasefire, cannot be another false dawn. Something more just and lasting is needed. Palestinians are beyond tired.
Joining me today to discuss Zahra's story is Fatima Dosa, who is a pharmacist and a political activist. Welcome, Fatima.
Thank you for inviting me. It's okay.
Yeah. Fatima, you've spent decades, you know, advocating for the rights of Palestinians, and all you've been doing so many different kind of things, you know, over the years. We have watched Palestinian women, you know, generation after generation, suffering what Zahra is talking about. She's 19 years old, but this is not something that, you know, she's born into it. Her mother was born into it. Her grandmother's gone through it. Fatima, will this ever end?
It's a very important question, Sakina. You know, you're right in saying that throughout our lifetime, you know, in my 40th decade, and that's all we've seen. It's the same conversations and it's the same stories. And the endurance of Palestinian women and what they've suffered is because of the, you know, dispossession, the displacements, the occupation, the apartheid. And it can only end when justice is done, when they're no longer living in fear. You know, they're fighting for their, what we're seeing in this genocide is they're fighting for their very existence. But I have every hope that this will end when Palestine will be free from the river to the sea. You know, as we are seeing, as the decades have gone by, their story has come more and more in the front. And we are seeing that the world has now woken up to the reality of what Palestine is, the dispossession, the occupation, and that Israel is now very much a pariah state. You know, the narrative has changed totally. And I have every hope that what we see in the liberation of Palestine, that it will not only be a dream that is whispered in the night, but it will be a lived reality for the Palestinians and for the women and the children that have gone through so much decade after decade.
Do you think it is this genocide that has created this momentum? I've said before, we've done processions for many years, but it would be, you know, when something happens, people go onto the street and then everybody forgets about it. You know, when we talk of the BDS, we boycott things for a while and then we go back into it. But do you think that has changed? Do you think the momentum in watching a live stream genocide has changed things?
You know, you're right. Again, this is the first time that we are seeing a live stream genocide and that the social media has captured this. You know, sometimes we blame social media for a lot of bad things, but actually it is social media that has opened a lot of people's eyes to the reality, because what they have seen cannot be unseen. You know, one thing that really, a phrase that caught me once when I was listening to Butchware, who was had stood up for the vice president of the Green Party in America, was that we have to move from being a moment, what happened with George Floyd was a moment, but to make it into a movement. And now what we see is a movement. You know, the outrage that we have seen is organized. That even when the ceasefire was called, the march that happened was the biggest after the ceasefire was called. People could see through that ceasefire and the superficiality of that ceasefire. And that people out on the streets, throughout the globe, in every strata of society, are committed to having that free Palestine and to stand in solidarity with the Palestinians and to make sure that their future now is not decided by the imperialists and the colonizers, but by the Palestinians themselves, including the people who have sought to have armed resistance, because unfortunately this is the only way that we will see the liberation of Palestine.
Absolutely, Fatima. And I wanted to bring in the issue of the Gen Z here, you know, because we watch Zahra. Zahra is only 19 years old, but she speaks with, you know, she's grown up more than a year in these 2 years, the wisdom with which she's talking, you know, of how she first talks about all the difficulties she has faced, you know, the fear of losing her brothers. And then she says, we're not going anywhere. We're not going to make it easy for them. You know, our parents, our grandmothers have resisted, and today's women will resist. How is this playing out for the rest of the world, the Gen Z? We see huge movement among them. Are they seeking direct, you know, inspiration from women like Zahra?
Absolutely. I think from the whole of Palestinians, that you know, we can see how the women have stood up, how the children have stood up. But even the men, sometimes even the men get forgotten in these. And I think what Gen Z is seeing is in the Palestinians is a clear, you know, moral clarity. They're seeing resistance, they're seeing resilience, and they're seeing the courage to stand up to the powers that be. And it's in their steadfastness, they're seeing not only the resilience and the resistance, but that even in the worst of times and in the darkest of times, that there is hope, and that you can stand up with compassion, with conviction. And you know, that is very apparent, that the Palestinians are not desperate.
Of course, along with the fact that, you know, not only are they brave, but their faith in God. You know, it's just astounding, because when they're going through the most difficult of times, you know, you will hear Hasbunallah wa ni'mal wakeel, which is such a strong faith. But finally, Fatima, we don't have much time left, but, you know, you run decolonization sessions. I want to quickly pick on that, because we've had, you know, some of our viewers saying that you should not be using the word colonization today, because for the white people who may not be colonized, who may already be on the side of resistance and pro-Palestinian, they feel like this is attacking white people around the world. What's your view on that?
It's an interesting question. It's a perspective I have to admit that I haven't really given much thought. But when I look at the reality out there, over the last 500 years, we are seeing imperialism and we're seeing colonization. You know, the colonization of lands may have gone, like I've grown up in Africa, but the colonization of our resources has not gone. The colonization of our minds have not gone. So it is a lived reality for many people that I feel the white people who may not be colonized and who can see through this have to understand that for majority of the world, colonization is what they are living with. And the face of that colonization is white supremacy and whiteness. So it's not something that we can just escape from. You know, we can't just say slavery didn't happen. We can't say apartheid didn't happen. It is a reality that for the people who are experiencing, it is very much a reality, and we have to understand that it is not something that we can just say.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, at least if there was no more colonization, then that's another issue.
Yeah.
But we're very much living, you know, presently with all sorts of colonized, you know, aspects in our lives. And finally, Fatima, you know, talking about home here, you know, and our responsibilities, the Tories were horrible, but the Keir Starmer's Labour has proven to be even worse. Our country has been complicit, continues to be complicit in this genocide, you know. What do we do? What is our role?
Yeah. I mean, you're right. You know, one thing that has the genocide, what we've witnessed, is a huge horror, but it's also very transformative, because what we've seen through that all the illusions of democracy, of rule of law, has fallen away. All the veils have gone. You know, the masks are off and the gloves are on. And it's important for us that this outrage is organized into a movement, and to make sure that the system, because you know, we come back to the fact that this is, whether it's Tories, whether it's the Labour Party, or whether it's the Liberal Democrats, it's the system that is an issue. But at the moment, we have to work in a two-pronged way. We have to work within the system to use their laws to make sure that we hold them to account, political account. So, you know, we make sure we don't vote for them, and that we have our own independent MPs, legal accountability, that we are using international law to bring them into court, which is what, you know, a lot of organizations like Al-Haq are doing, to say that, for example, you cannot sell arms to a country that is committing genocide. So we should hold them to account. We should hold the leaders into account. And also the institutions that are like the media institutions, the NGOs.
Thank you all. We leave you with the sounds of Palestine by the artist Saif. Goodbye.
Welcome back, dear listeners, and thank you for staying with us on Iran Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. Muslim scholar Ibn al-Haytham, known as Al-Hazen in Europe, who was born in 965 AD, formulated the scientific method and has been referred to as the world's first true scientist. He is also often regarded as the first theoretical physicist, making a significant contribution to the theory of light and optics. Additionally, he developed what is called celestial mechanics, which led to the eventual work of Europeans such as Copernicus, Galileo, Johannes Kepler, and Isaac Newton. We'll listen to the continuation of Iran Radio. Thank you for joining us. Coming up in this hour, we begin with the spotlight. Right after that, we turn to For Humanity, a reflective program that explores key aspects of human life as addressed in the Holy Quran, from personal development to social relationships and family dynamics. This segment offers a Quranic perspective on how to live with purpose and compassion in both private and communal life. Then stay tuned for Africa Today, where we take a comprehensive look at the political, economic, cultural, and business landscape across the African continent. This program provides a valuable overview of developments shaping Africa's present and future. Up next, Spotlight. Stay with us. There is much to explore.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The plight of Palestinian inmates in Israeli prisons has become a defining human rights crisis, exposing what many advocacy groups and international observers describe as systematic crimes against detainees. Reports from UN agencies and Palestinian prisoner advocacy groups document a disturbing pattern of torture, sexual violence, starvation, medical neglect, and arbitrary detention without trial. With thousands imprisoned, including women and children, many held under administrative detention, the incarceration system has become an extension of broader policies of domination and dehumanization. I am Bahman Nouri, your host, and this spotlight seeks to see whether these practices constitute not isolated abuses, but a deliberate institutionalized machinery of oppression that violates international law and the most fundamental principles of human dignity. Let us begin with a report.
Since the outbreak of Israel's genocidal war on Gaza, Palestinian men and women held in Israeli military and prison facilities have faced systematic ill-treatment, including torture, sexual violence, and severe neglect. Many have died after being abducted and held under inhuman conditions. According to a 2024 report by the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, many inmates from Gaza and the West Bank have been held arbitrarily.